Ready to proceed?
Mr. Chief Justice Steele, Mr. Justice Holland, Mr. Justice Jacobs, it's a pleasure for me to be here again. I don't get down here as often as I used to, but saves me from getting humiliated as much as I used to get humiliated. But it's a pleasure to come down and argue again before Your Honors. This is an appeal from a Superior Court conviction of two counts of unlawful sexual contact in the second degree for Jose Cabrera. The offense occurring in August of 2003, and there were, just to fill things out just a little bit, there was a lengthy, I did not handle the trial. Mr. Hyden handled the trial, so I became involved on the appeal. But having familiarized myself with the case, there was a very long period of pretrial delay involving lots of motions that were filed, none of which are at issue here before Your Honors. I submitted two arguments in connection with the appeal, and I would, if I could, like to focus on the first one, which I think presents a more novel question to the court, which I don't believe this court has been confronted with before, having to do with the proper course of action that the trial court should have taken here when confronted with the jury's note, which kind of reflected some of the issues that they were grappling with in their deliberations. As the court will recall, very briefly and as succinctly as possible, the issue arises in the context of
May I ask you a question
before
you get into the substance? Mm-hmm. I'm a bit confused by the note that the jury sent. As I understood it, there were two charges, correct?
There were.
And they were the same?
They were.
But the jury note says, our question has to do with the third part of the charge, first count, the defendant acting intentionally.
Correct.
Why is it just the third part of the first count?
I don't know why they didn't question about the second count, or whether, I guess we're just speculating at this point in time, whether the
argument applies to both charges.
My argument does. I think the state takes a different position, but there were two separate discrete incidents, as the court will recall from reviewing the statement of facts. So the state.
My only point is, if it's about their question applies not just to one count, but to.
Although they mentioned count one, I think the fair reading is that it should apply to both counts.
Sorry.
Thank you. Obviously, the facts. I mean, I think it's a pretty interesting issue. The victim in this case, as the court knows, was 15. So obviously, under our statutes, any sexual contact with a 15-year-old by an adult is criminal in nature. The testimony of the victim is that it was late at night, after 1:30 in the morning, at some point in time, and she awakened to finding a man next to her who she never identified, but identity is not an issue here, rubbing her vagina, and he did that for a short period of time, stopped, left, she fell asleep, and that person then returned, and in addition to rubbing the vagina on the second time, actually got into bed with her and started to kiss her and touch her in similar fashion. She finally jumps up out of bed, unlocks the door, which she said had previously been locked, went into the bathroom, waited there, and disclosed it immediately to a couple other children that were there, after which they went to her coach's home. So the facts are really, really very simple. The defendant also testified, and when the defendant testified, what's interesting from the jury note, and the state also raises in their brief, the defendant testified that he believed that the individual let me back up just a little bit. He had fallen asleep in that bedroom earlier in the night while working with his son, and he believed, after he felt the child's leg, that it was his daughter in the bed and that he only kissed her. And he only testified that occurred on one occasion. The jury's note suggests, I would submit to the court, that they believed part of the defendant's testimony, but not all of the defendant's testimony. And it suggests to me that the note And the proper analysis here is that they believed that the defendant did not intend to have any contact with the actual victim, but believed that it was his daughter in the room. But at the same time, it seems to me, in reading the note fairly, that they did not accept the testimony that he gave that there was no sexual contact between the two. So if you kind of put them all together, or put those two different aspects of the case together, it raises the issue here. And if I can frame the issue in the way that I did in the brief, is that if you assume that the defendant, according to the jury's finding, intended to have sexual contact with a person who he did not believe was the victim, then there was no crime committed because there was no lesser included here. And the jury was not instructed on unlawful sexual contact in the second degree, so it was either guilty or not guilty. And, excuse me, the daughter, as Mr. Hyden pointed out in his dialogue with the court, there was no testimony in the case as to how old the daughter was, so that if the jury believed that the defendant intended to have sexual contact with the daughter, then under the factual circumstances here, no crime would have been proven.
Why not?
Well, a crime would have been proven, but it would have been unlawful sexual contact in the third degree.
Why?
Because there's no evidence of the daughter's age. It has to be less than 16. So there was no evidence in the record what the daughter's age was. There was reference in the record to Joanna Cabrera, who was a friend of the victims and whose house it was, but there was never any testimony brought out during in the record as to what her age was. So that if we can assume for the moment that that would have been an unlawful sexual contact third degree crime, the jury was not instructed on that, and that was not an alternative that they had at their disposal. So that was one scenario of events we would suggest that the jury was grappling with, and we would also suggest, for the reasons that were articulated in the brief, that the instruction in this case was just wrong.
At this point, why wasn't there a request for a jury instruction on a lesser included offense?
Because there was none under the state's theory of the case. Under the state's theory of the case, the crime could only have been unlawful sexual contact in the second degree because the fact that the victim in the case was under 16. So there was no lesser included to give.
Well, we know there wasn't a request for a lesser.
There was not a request. And indeed, under the state's theory, this jury note kind of threw everything out of whack a little bit. That's not a very legal term to use, but it sort of changed the dynamic of the case in terms of what they were considering, and it required the judge then to give an instruction, which it would appear neither side had anticipated would be an issue in the case. Now, when I went back and I looked at the, in preparing for this today, I went back and I looked at the exchanges between the court and the counsel on this because I understand the state's arguing plain error. I mean, it looks like it went really fast. And in fact, when you go to page 37 of the transcript, I don't know what that corresponds to the A, but where the jury notice talked about it, there's really hardly anything given to us about what the note was or what the judge planned on doing. Mr. Hyden seems to have articulated the argument without using mistake of fact and without using those words on page 39 of the actual transcript. But once the jury raised that question, I would submit that the instruction compelled the jury to find this defendant guilty. And I think it should be fairly clear that this is not a transferred intent case. As cited in the brief, classically at common law in Delaware, and it's well recognized in Delaware, a transfer intent case is a case where you shoot one person who you don't intend to shoot, but you intended to shoot another person. So you transfer the intent from the actual victim to the intended, from the intended victim to the actual victim.
Well, maybe explain why that doesn't work in a situation where you intended to commit sexual assault on a 16-year-old, but you commit sexual assault on a 15-year-old instead?
Well, once again, Mr. Chief Justice, that goes back to my argument under the unusual circumstances of this case. If the victim in this case was the defendant's daughter, the proper charge, assuming that the age hadn't been proven, which had not been proven here, would have been unlawful sexual contact in the third degree. If the facts were as the defendant believed them to be, which I would submit is the crux of the mistake of fact defense, if the defendant believed that that was his daughter, and I use the word wife not because he ever testified to that, it's just because that was the only other person in the house. But if that's what he believed, then under the facts, if she was over 16, what he did was contact third degree, because that's the difference between second and third is the age. So if that was an option for the jury, then they could have considered contact third degree if they believed that he believed that it was his daughter. But under the unusual jury instructions in this case, excuse me, that was not an option for the jury. So it was either guilty of the original offense or not guilty. But transferred intent, I submit, has no application here. Now, if there was evidence in the case that the defendant's daughter was 15 and that the jury believed that he intended to sexually assault her, then I would agree that transferred intent would be appropriate. But here, if the facts were as the defendant believed them to be, then he was not committing the crime of unlawful sexual contact in the second degree, but rather contact third degree. The mistake that he arguably made and that the jury found, or appears to have found, that he made negative the commission of unlawful sexual contact in the second degree, creating the misdemeanor offense because of the fact that there's nothing in the record about the other person's age. So I think...
But on the facts of this case, neither the jury nor we on appeal could conclude that the appropriate charge should be third degree.
The jury had no...
Right, I understand.
Okay, you get that.
Are you suggesting we couldn't remand with instructions to enter a finding of guilt on third degree because it wasn't fairly presented to the jury?
I think that the jury was never given the opportunity to consider contact in the third degree, number one. And number two, I don't think that it would be appropriate under those circumstances. That's really not number two. It's still number one. Since they never had the option in the first place to consider contact third, I don't think that this court could remand to enter a conviction on a charge that wasn't charged upon to the jury, which creates, I suppose, if that's the course of conduct that was taken, I mean, it might create some pause, but I think that this whole what happened here was totally unanticipated by the prosecutor.
Well, it's pretty clear what the jury thought from their mm-hmm. their note.
Mm-hmm.
They thought he intended to commit sexual contact. It just wasn't on the person
correct
that he thought it was
correct.
And doesn't that lead to the argument that the state makes, which you haven't addressed, namely that the mistake here was as to the identity of the victim, not the victim's age. The identity is expressly carved out of the transferred intent statute, 762A, I believe. And that statute in these circumstances would mandate, if not would authorize at least, if not mandate, a transferred intent instruction.
Well, I would suggest quite respectfully that that's not the case in this situation here, where when you quote unquote transfer the intent, it's not a crime, or else it's not the crime that the person's charged with. I mean, if you do a transfer, and I understand the state's argument, and I appreciate the court's inquiry in that regard, when you transfer intent on a murder or an attempted murder or on an arson or something of that nature, it's still a crime. But when you're I don't like to use the word transferring intent, there's a mistake as to who the victim is. It's not dissimilar from a person waking up in their bed at night thinking that their wife is lying beside them when, in fact, it's their daughter who's young, and then you touch your daughter thinking that it's your wife. It's a similar kind of a thing where the intent to commit that particular crime is not there. Now, I think I only have...
Your point is that under 762A, it's not a mistake as to age of an individual that you intended to assault. It's a mistake as to the individual who happens to be in...
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not
a mistake. Do you want to save the balance of your time?
I'd like to, if I could. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, if it pleases the court. I would like to start with that jury note because the jury's note is very specific, and as jury notes go, they're asking for some very specific information. They narrowed down. First of all, as the court mentioned already, they're only interested in count one. The defendant is charged with two identical counts. The victim here, Jessica, testified that there were two incidents, one separated by a certain amount of time, and then the second entrance into the house, into the bedroom, and the second assault. The jury here is only interested in one, and it's interesting that the defendant, in his various and sundry, his first statement to the victim's father the morning after, and then in his testimony, only testifies as to one incident. So the jury apparently is going to accept, at least entertain the possibility, that the first time there was indeed this mistake as to the identity of the body in the bed that Mr. Cabrera was going to touch, but would not accept that this happened twice. That's how I read the note. In other words, count two is out. The old saying goes, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. All right, we will at least entertain the possibility that you made this mistake once. We are not going to entertain the possibility that you made it twice. When you went back there the second time, you knew what you were about. So that's how I read why their note is concentrating only on the first count of the indictment. And then, as the court has already pointed out and Mr. Merrick concedes, the jury does not want an instruction accepting all of the defendant's testimony. If you accept all of the defendant's testimony, no crime occurred regardless of the identity of the individual in the bed. He testified that his testimony was only that he kissed a forehead and there was a leg sticking out and he put the leg back in. Neither of those touchings constitute unlawful sexual contact under our definitional statute, regardless of the identity of the person contacted. If you take a look at what he told the victim's father, he climbed into bed and prayed. That does not. There was no touching at all there. But that's what he did with his children. So, again, no sexual contact. Accepting his testimony at face value, all of it, the mistake that he urges really is irrelevant. He committed no crime whatsoever. However, the jury's note indicates that they did not accept that part of his testimony. They believe that he did, in fact, intend to commit or intended to have sexual contact with whomever was in the bed. He testified he thought it was his child or his daughter. Of course, the victim testified it was, of course, herself, and she was under the age of 16. Now, this, I think, is why the mistake of fact. And I pointed out in my brief that no such instruction was asked for. But even if asked for, the judge would have been correct in denying it because, and the code commentary is very clear on this, that mistake of fact must negate criminal intent altogether. That is, if you accept a defendant's testimony that he was mistaken as to this fact, honestly mistaken as to this fact, then the defendant set out to commit no crime whatsoever. And at the jury's deliberations here, reading their note, they had already decided that the defendant had set out to commit a crime.
Well, if I follow the argument that your colleague has made, it is that, given this mistake of fact, no crime whatsoever was committed.
And Mr. Maurer and I agree on a great deal. As I was listening to him, I was struck on that, but I don't understand his final conclusion. The problem is mistake of fact. And a mistake of fact defense, you must raise it saying, I committed no crime. Now, Mr. Cabrera's testimony was that he committed no crime, but any mistake had nothing to do with his exculpatory testimony. He said, regardless of any mistake as to the identity of the person in the bed, he committed no crime at all. So his defense, his complete defense, was not that I was mistaken and therefore I committed no crime. His complete defense was I committed no crime at all, regardless of any mistake I made. So his was a totally exculpatory defense. So mistake in under the facts.
Well, I thought Mr. Maurer's argument was that there was only one charge submitted to the jury, and an element of the charge was the age of the victim, and that if the jury thought the victim was the defendant's daughter, that the instruction was erroneous in the absence of any proof of her age.
The instruction of transferred intent.
Transferred intent. Mr. Maurer agrees if there was evidence that the daughter and the friend were both under 16, transferred intent would have been an appropriate instruction. But the error in this case was to suggest if the jury thought the victim was the daughter, intent could be transferred because there was no evidence of the daughter's age.
Yeah, I think the trial judge addressed that and said that under our sexual statutes, ignorance of age or mistake as to age is no defense here. You take your victim as you find your victim. And so the
well,
judge
how would that work out hypothetically if we knew the daughter was 18? Yeah. Not under 16. Wouldn't it have been an error to give the transferred intent instruction? In my hypothetical, you need to assume there's evidence that the friend is under 16 and the daughter is 18. And the jury thinks the confusion was between the friend and the daughter. You would agree you couldn't give a transferred intent instruction if the evidence showed the daughter was 18.
If the evidence showed that his contact with the daughter was not illegal.
Now, I'm assuming the contact.
With consent.
Well, now, I'm assuming that it's a crime to have sexual contact with your daughter, you know, when she's 18, 17, whatever. But we'll pick an age where it would be illegal. The purpose of my hypothetical is to try to find the state's position with regard to the absence of evidence on the daughter's age.
No, whoever you end up abusing, the age of that person is what counts. And so one does not have to know that. That's the state's position. It's as if the defendant, say, met some young lady who assured him that she was 18 years old and said, well, let's go have some fun. He said, okay, let me see your driver's license. Shows him a fake driver's license. He does everything possible, and it turns out she's 15. He's guilty because you take that victim as you find that victim, that age of victim. If I throw a rock at somebody intending to assault someone I know is 30, and the rock misses and hits someone who's 65, the fact that I have assaulted the 65-year-old.
Yeah, well, let's take your situation. Let's say that this woman has shown the ID and done everything else and says, meet me in Motel 6, room 101. He goes into the dark motel room, and it turns out that the woman he believes identified herself as she did, is not there, but it's her 14-year-old sister who's substituting for her that
day. Yes.
He never intended to commit sexual assault on a 14-year-old. He intended to have sex with a consenting 18-year-old. Now, maybe he's still guilty of something, but is he guilty of unlawful sexual contact with a 14-year-old?
I'm wondering, under that particular set of facts, a mistake of fact defense wouldn't be the appropriate instruction rather than transferred intent, because the defendant went into that motel room intending that no crime at all be committed, say there was no money that was going to transfer. This was simply two consenting adults, and it was not patronizing a prostitute or anything. He was simply going in there simply to have a good time. It may have been morally problematic, but that's neither here nor there. He was going to commit no crime whatsoever. Then I think a mistake of fact defense, since he went in there with a clear legal conscience.
Would that analysis also apply to the hypothetical that was posed by Mr. Maurer? That is, a man goes to bed in a dark bedroom, has sexual contact with the woman who's lying next to him, who he believes is his wife. It turns out that it's his daughter, whether underage or whatever.
Well, again, there was no criminal mens rea to begin with, and so the mistake of fact, I think, would then be the appropriate instruction. I think it depends, really, all whether there's a criminal. Whoever is the actor here, the defendant to be.
Your statement to us earlier was that mistake of fact must negate criminal intent altogether.
Yes.
Is that how you're applying that nostrum?
Yes. If there is no criminal intent whatsoever in what the actor intends to do, and it only appears criminal because of the mistake of fact, then the actor should be excused for his action, since he went into that act through no mistake of his – I mean, went into whatever he was doing, thinking that what he was about to do was perfectly legal.
But as I understand Mr. Maurer's argument, he's assuming – the intent was criminal.
Yes.
And the question is, who was the victim? Was it the daughter or the friend? Mr. Maurer's argument is, if he had criminal intent to engage in illegal contact with his daughter, he could have only been guilty of a third-degree offense, not a second-degree offense, and that the problem in this case was transferring the intent to the second-degree offense.
And I disagree with Justice Holland. I see no difference between that particular scenario and simply being mistaken as to the age of the person with whom you are about to have sex. I see no difference whatsoever. You're mistaken as to age. You're mistaken as to identity. If this person is underage, in this case 15 years old, then you have unlawful sexual contact, second degree, rather than unlawful sexual contact in the third degree. So I suppose the critical distinction I make here is whether you enter into the act with a clear mind, that is, intending no crime whatsoever, and only by virtue of a reasonable mistake. Again, that's for the jury to decide whether...
Well, is it your position that what the judge was telling the jury is to this effect? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, even if you think he intended to have this sexual contact with his daughter, he still can be guilty of the offense as charged.
Yes.
That's what the judge was saying.
That is what the judge is saying. In effect, that's what the judge is saying. As I read this jury note, I mean, that final sentence there, is it still okay? Now, this is non-legal language. That could just as easily read. Does the defendant's intent to have unlawful sexual contact transfer from the one he thought was there to the one who was actually there, which is basically what the jury is asking, and that, I think, is why the judge, I mean, that note basically cries out for a transfer of intent instruction. I think that under the facts of this case, considering both the testimony of the victim, the testimony of the defendant, transferred intent instruction and the jury's note, all-important jury's note, that the transferred intent instruction was the correct one and that a mistake of fact instruction would have been incorrect. But the court has no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think I need to use all my time. Mr. Justice Holland, I think you've articulated the argument that I'm making, but, and I know by your saying it, it doesn't make you lean one way or the other, but that's precisely what the defendant's argument is in this case. I think the state is, whether or not there's criminal intent to begin with, I don't, from our point of view, I don't see it as being terribly relevant here, because the difference is, although there's criminal intent, if the facts are as the defendant believes them to be, it's of a different level crime, which here makes a tremendous amount of difference, in this case, whether the defendant would have been convicted of a misdemeanor or a felony, given his status and what happens when you get convicted of a felony with deportation and things of that nature. So it's very, very significant.
Is there any significance to whether he would have been entitled to a mistake of fact charge when there are no facts to support that he made a factual mistake from his own testimony? He says he committed no crime at all.
And that's the other point I did want to address as well. He does, but the jury obviously didn't accept that. They chose to accept part of his testimony and reject the other part of his testimony, if you accept that note at face value. The jury accepted the fact that he was mistaken about the person that was in that bed, or at least they were considering that issue so that they should have been instructed on it, but they obviously rejected the fact that he had no criminal intent whatsoever. I don't think that's germane to my argument.
Well, it may not be germane to your argument, but the state's position is that you're not entitled to a mistake of fact charge when your own defense says there was no mistake of fact because it just didn't happen.
I understand that point, but just because the defendant said that he didn't do it doesn't mean that the jury wasn't accepting all of his testimony. The jury accepted part of his testimony and were considering how they should then decide the case based on that. It's not that unusual in criminal trials for the jury to flat out reject the defendant's testimony, but then look at the state's case and see what the appropriate verdict should be, whether it's a lesser included offense or something of that nature.
But I understand that, but what we're talking about here, at least as I understand it, is whether as a matter of law, in the absence of explicitly submitting one, he was entitled to have the jury charged on mistake of fact, and it was legal error to charge the jury on transferred intent. I understand the state's position to be we don't have to go beyond the fact that asking for that charge is so inconsistent with his defense that it would make no sense to give it.
Well, it would have been in the first instance had there been no jury note. Once the jury note came in, I think had everybody taken enough time to – it looks like it happened really fast from what I can see. There was very little discussion back and forth. Mr. Hyden articulated the very argument that I'm making on appeal but didn't use the words mistake of fact. And then the court just went ahead and gave the instruction. So I don't – there's some mention in there saying, you know, how should I handle this, but no opportunity to do it. I agree. In the first instance, the defendant would have never submitted a mistake of fact instruction in this case. It serendipitously happened when the jury came back with the note indicating that they were focusing their deliberative process on that particular issue.
You're suggesting that in the heat of the moment or the exigencies of time, Mr. Hyden probably decided to keep it a one-count, all-or-nothing case. And what he would have wanted the jury to focus on is if you don't think he intended to have this illegal contact with this particular victim, then you can't find him guilty as charged because you need to focus on all of the elements of the offense and in particular the age element.
I believe that was Mr. Hyden's position, and I think he probably, in looking back at this, was as surprised at the jury's note as anybody who was involved in the trial. I think it probably took everybody by surprise. It was never... Other than the defendant just getting up there saying that I thought it was my daughter, he wasn't really using that to say that he committed a different crime. Obviously, the jury focused on that because that was the only time that was mentioned in the entire trial.
Mr. Maurer, yes, I take it from the absence of citations in your brief to anything other than Delaware authorities that this issue has not come up anywhere?
I did not find it with regard to this particular age issue with any cases that I could find. I guess I'm being told
I know
to
your
stop.
Time's up, but I have another question.
Yes, sir.
You heard Mr. Donovan explain his understanding of the meaning of the jury note, which really would cause us to focus, if we were focused on reversing, only on the conviction for one count. Do you agree with his reasoning?
I disagree with that.
Why?
I think just because the jury didn't articulate it with regard to both counts, we can't assume that it wasn't a common thread. And absent further explanation by them, I don't think we can get here and come up here in retrospect and say, well, it was only an issue on the first incident, not on the second incident.
Even though they expressly say their question has to do with the third part of the charge, first count.
I would say no, because I would say my position is well-founded because the jury charge was the same for counts one and count two. So if you get an answer on one, you get an answer on two. It's the exact same jury charge because it was the exact same charge. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.